Morning, everyone. It's good to be here with all of you today. We are, as Austin spoiled for you, continuing our discussion on wisdom. We are finishing up with the book of Ecclesiastes. And what we're doing specifically is we're taking a look at how Proverbs, Job, and now Ecclesiastes all help us to understand that key phrase, the fear of the Lord. Proverbs tells us that it is the very beginning of wisdom. And practically speaking, is this wholehearted and sincere devotion and submission to God and his ways. Job, as we looked at last week, gives it some more nuance, though. We're not fearing God if we're simply trying to manipulate him with our good behavior and hopefully get all the blessings promised in the book of Proverbs. Well, Ecclesiastes asks us, what is the point of fearing God if our entire life is pointless? It looks at traditional wisdom found in Proverbs. It gives it an honest shot, but ultimately ends up disappointed. Before you even read the book, we're told what the conclusion is. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Rather than seeing a world and a life that makes sense, the preacher sees vanity. It's a very interesting Hebrew word. It's used to describe mist and things without substance. And so I like to think of the preacher as someone who can see life, but just like pursuing or trying to grasp the wind, any time you try and grab a hold of it, it just slips right through. It's not anything that he can actually hold on to. It's there, but he can't seem to grasp it. And so as a result, everything is vain. Other translations say everything is meaningless, everything is futile. My favorite is absurd. Absurdity of absurdity, says the preacher. Everything is absurd. And I like that translation because the preacher is not just depressed about how empty life is. He's frustrated. It should make sense, but it's absurd, and that frustrates him. And as we read through this book, and as we consider the ultimate conclusion, a lot of people don't like the book of Ecclesiastes. Every time I have ended up teaching Ecclesiastes in sermons or in Bible classes, there's always a few people who want to fight against it somehow. They want to explain away all the difficult passages. They want to rationalize it, make it happier, jump to the silver linings in life that it hints at. There are some of those in the book, but I think if we are going to try and make the preacher someone who preaches joy, then we might be doing a disservice to the book. In Ecclesiastes, we have the wisdom and meditation of a man who struggles with the idea of how the world should be going, but everything he sees under the sun goes against it. So we're going to let the preacher have his say, give full vent to his frustrations with life, and understand what is it that makes life so vain to the preacher. We can start off in chapter 3, looking at verses 1 through 11. One of the first frustrations that the preacher gives vent to is not knowing the proper timing. In Ecclesiastes 3, starting at verse 1, he says, "For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time for love and a time for hate, a time for war and a time for peace." This is one of those poems, when read in isolation, actually has made people, in my experience, feel good, because there is a time and season for all the events in life. So as we find ourselves in a time for laughing, we appreciate it just that much more, knowing that times of weeping might be around the corner. And it also gives people kind of this hopeful sense of, okay, if I'm in the midst of conflict, it's only for a time and it's only for a season. These disasters don't last forever, and even better, it absolves us of any blame if we're in these miserable situations. It's not my fault, it's just a time and a season for this to happen. You're not suffering because you're a bad person. Time and chance happen to all alike, and it just happens to be that time. But the preacher's frustrated because he wants to know, what time is it right now? Think about all of the successes and failures in your life, and think about how much of that was dependent on the timing of it all. One of the important things found in wisdom literature is the need to know the proper time to do things. For example, Proverbs 15:23, to make an apt answer is a joy to man, and a word in season how good it is. Have you ever had someone say the right thing at the wrong time? Is it proper and good to propose at someone else's wedding? Do you announce your pregnancy at a person's funeral? That's all great news. We're all happy that that's happening, but that's not the time or the season to be announcing something like that. And so what is frustrating for the preacher is there's a time and a season for everything, but he doesn't know what the fitting time is for what he's experiencing. In Ecclesiastes 3, 9 through 11, he asks, what benefit can a worker gain from his toil? I've observed the burden that God has given to people to keep them occupied. God has made everything fit beautifully in its appropriate time, but he has also placed ignorance in the human heart so that people can't discover what God has ordained from beginning to the end of their lives. The preacher says, I can't figure this out. Yeah, there's a time for everything, but I can't figure it out. Wouldn't it be great to know the perfect timing? When's the perfect time to ask that special someone out on a date? When's the perfect time to invest in different companies? When is the perfect time that you can leave home and avoid all the red lights and just sail on into your destination? Wouldn't that just be wonderful? But the preacher's frustrated because he doesn't know the time. We don't know the time. And so he understands that you can do all of the right things. You can drive safely. You can obey all the rules of the law, but find yourself in an intersection at the wrong time as a drunk driver T-bones you. Timing's everything. And so he says in Ecclesiastes 9, 11 through 12, again, I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. Man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. You can control your actions. Strive to be the fastest, the strongest, the smartest, but you cannot control time and chance. And when an evil time comes upon all of your good efforts, it can destroy all of it. And so the random nature of life leads to a second complaint and frustration that leads the preacher to declare all is vain. And that would be injustice. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 1 through 3. He says, all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man doesn't know. Both are before him. It is the same for all. Since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner. And he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. So as much as the movies and the comic books and all the great things in life want to tell us and idolize the idea that the good guy always wins, the preacher has experienced real life. And he says, more often than I care to admit, the bad guy wins. And so whether you are good or you are evil, when you find yourself in the hands of God, he says, I don't know if he loves or hates me. It doesn't matter what good I do, I can still get bad results. It doesn't matter how evil some people are, they still get good results. Consider the story of Cain and Abel, right? Cain does everything right, doesn't he? He offers the proper sacrifice, he's accepted by God, and what does he get rewarded with? He's murdered. Meanwhile, Cain, the one who did murder him, he offers the improper sacrifice. He talks back to God, "Where's my brother? Am I my brother's keeper?" He murders his brother out of a jealous rage, and what does he get? He gets a divine mark of protection so that no one will pursue him and kill him. He goes off and builds a city with his wife and family, and even down to the seventh generation, his descendants remember him. Abel did everything right and got everything wrong. Cain did everything wrong, but seems to have gotten everything right. What I think is doubly fascinating about the story of Abel is that in Hebrew, you spell Abel the same word that you spell vanity of vanities. It's the same word. It's as if Abel himself is the perfect example of why life can be so vain. We have all seen this kind of stuff, haven't we? We've seen where good things happen to some of the worst people in our lives and then wonder why some of the best people, how some of the worst things happen to the best. A couple weeks ago, we got the news that Caitlin Pierce died on the operating table. Why did that happen to her and not some mass murderer or criminal or scum of the earth? Why did it have to happen to her? The random nature of life, which leads to so much injustice, just leaves the preacher with the impression that we got no reasonable way to truly understand if God actually loves or hates us. Worshiping or cursing him, he says, doesn't really seem to have any effect on my life. Your morality seems to have no ultimate bearing on how much you get to enjoy life. And so the preacher, you can understand, is rather frustrated at this. But let's assume for a moment that you've escaped these frustrations. Let's assume that you're one of the lucky ones. Let's assume the timing in your life does work out. Everything just falls into place. You get every green light on the way to work and back. You get the perfect timing of the market. You strike it rich. Everything is just coming up honey for you. You can avoid bad timing. You can avoid injustice just through sheer time and chance. But there's one thing that no one can avoid. In Ecclesiastes 3:19, what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So here we have the ultimate vanity. Death is the end of all living. And it doesn't matter how long that life is. It doesn't matter how good or bad that life is. It always comes to an end. And just like the dog, we just kind of fade into the dust from which we were taken, only to have all the good things that we did have in life taken away and passed on to our descendants. And whether he'll be wise or a fool, the preacher says, who knows? Vanity of vanities. And so just as the preacher begins, so he ends in chapter 12, verse 8. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. So after hearing that, we might be wondering, if that's all that life is, then what's the point? There is a school of philosophy called absurdism. It's largely pioneered by this man, Albert Camus. He's a Frenchman. You might have read his book, The Stranger, in high school. It's on a lot of different lists. Well, he also wrote a book called The Myth of Sisyphus. And if you know your Greek mythology, essentially Sisyphus angers the gods and is cursed for eternity to roll a big boulder up a hill every single day. And guess what happens at the end of every single day? The rock comes rolling back down. And so he has to trudge back down the hill and start the whole process over again. Well, Camus, like the preacher, says, that's what all of our lives are. We're all just rolling rocks up hills, and it accomplishes nothing, because guess what? We all die. And when you die, there is nothing. There is no point to life. It's all vain. It would be absurd to try and find meaning in this life. So Camus wonders in this book, Would it be better if I just killed myself? Because if we're just going to die anyways, why wait around? If life can be so unfair, why take the chance of life getting worse? Let's just stop the whole show right now. Who cares? What does the preacher have to say, though? In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 4 through 6, he says that he who is joined with all the living has hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. So despite the certainty of death, the preacher says life is better. As inevitable as death is, and as frustrating and vain as life is, the preacher says it's all you have. And once you die, you have nothing. Better a living dog than a dead lion, because the dog has, at the very least, a hope that tomorrow might get better. Now, all of this, I'm sure, is just, you know, the most thrilling and uplifting material you could ever imagine hearing in a sermon. But that's kind of the point of Ecclesiastes. Wisdom is going to make us contemplate and confront some of the more depressing and difficult realities of life. And Ecclesiastes here is not just a complaint. It's still wisdom. It's still teaching us on how to live with skill, how to live life well in the face of certain death. And the preacher has something interesting to say. Contrary to popular belief, ignorance is not bliss. Most people are pretty bummed on learning at just how vain, empty, absurd, and pointless their life is. But to the preacher, he says, it is by understanding how empty our life is that can lead us to live the best life possible. For example, Ecclesiastes 9, 7 through 10. He says, go eat your bread with joy. Drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments always be white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hands find to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. This is one of five times where we're told to do just this. Eat, drink, and be merry. The preacher says that is the best way you could possibly live your vain life. Enjoy luxury. Drink your wine. Let your garments be white. Put on some comfy clothes. Live in pajamas. Anoint yourself with oil. Take pleasureship in the companionship of the wife that you have. Whatever portion in life that you find yourself to have, live it up. Do it with might, he says, because where you're going, there's nothing left. So whether life gives you a single dollar or a million, make sure you spend every last penny. In a strange twist of irony, the preacher says that it's only in the light of certain death that we can actually live life to the fullest. It's only in recognizing life's vanity that we can actually find some sort of satisfaction in it. This is Etty Hillesum. She is a Jewish woman who was born and raised in the Netherlands, and she was murdered at the age of 29 in Auschwitz. Vanity of vanities. Up to that point of her death, she kept a journal, recording all of the anti-Jewish measures being imposed by the Germans as they occupied her country, and just this growing uncertainty that she faced as more and more Jews are being deported and more rumors are coming back about why they're deporting all of the Jews. And she never denied any of the tragedies that she faced, but she kept a journal of them. Before Auschwitz, she spent 2 months in Westerbork concentration camp, and she wrote, "The sky is full of birds. The purple lupins stand up so regally and peacefully. Two little old women have sat down for a chat. The sun is shining on my face, and right before our eyes, mass murder." The whole thing is simply beyond comprehension. And as she continues to write, her fear is growing. Death is becoming more and more certain, and she understands how little of it she has left to live. But over time, that fear begins to change her into somebody who recognizes and accepts death and all the suffering that comes with it. And it is this acceptance of death that leads her to write things like this. She says, "Those 2 months behind barbed wire have been the two richest and most intense months of my life in which my highest values were so deeply confirmed. I have learned to love Westerbork, her concentration camp." And it was only because she was able to get a good grasp on the vanity of life that she began to truly appreciate it. I think it is this similar mode of thinking that inspires the preacher to write passages like Ecclesiastes 7, 2 through 4, where he says, "It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth." The only ones, the preacher says, who can actually find joy, lift up their face, are the ones who have come to terms with the end of life. And so what are we supposed to do, the preacher says, in the face of all this disaster? Ecclesiastes 3:13, "The all of man is that he should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man." Now, that's a really wooden translation of verse 13 in order to highlight some wordplay we'll notice a little bit on. But that's what the preacher says it is. This is the all of man. This is all you get, so enjoy it. Now, some people are going to possibly be really inspired by that kind of message and be able to find beauty even in the vain life that they have. But I still can't help but shake the feeling that we're putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. Is the all of man simply to eat, drink, and be merry? Well, thankfully, while the preacher has the longest word in the book of Ecclesiastes, he does not have the last words. Ecclesiastes 12, 9 through 11. Notice how the pronouns shift. "Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by the one shepherd." Notice how it's no longer I, the preacher, am saying these things, but another voice has come in and said, "This is what the preacher said." It's as if the preacher has given his view on life, and at the end of his speech, like one of the elders has to come up and say, "Now, hold up a little bit. We got to clarify some things." And this is what the commentator wants to clarify for us. The first thing to note is he says the preacher's wise. We can't simply dismiss everything that we've read as a cynical lunatic who doesn't know what he's talking about. There's wisdom in it. And second, he says he's writing words of truth. Life really is unfair in all of those reasons we've just read. And like goads and nails, they hurt. But they're designed to push us into wise living. And we're also warned about going beyond his teaching. "My son," he's now addressing us specifically, "beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh." He says, we're not going to do any better than the preacher in solving the riddle of a vain life. There is wisdom, there is truth in what he said, but it's not the end of the matter. Here's the real end of the matter. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the all of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So do you catch how verse 13 here echoes what we read earlier in the book in chapter 3, verse 13? the all of man is to eat, drink, and be merry. No, 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 no. The commentator at the end says, here's the all of man. Fear God and keep his commandments. It's a deliberate callback and critique of the solution to life that we've just been offered. The final commentator here says that the all of man goes back to the very beginning of wisdom. Fear God and keep his commandments. And that might sound like kind of an anticlimax. But just as Job doesn't reject the fear of God, but instead kind of gives us further instruction on it, that's what Ecclesiastes is helping us do. It is helping us go back to our roots, but in a more nuanced and fuller sense. I'm sure most of you know the name Gordon Ramsay, right? He's the celebrity chef who has like Hell's Kitchen, and he's always shouting and cussing at people. It's kind of his shtick that he's the angry chef. And most people would consider him one of the world's greatest chefs. And he's a character, but the person I find more interesting than Gordon Ramsay is the man who taught Gordon Ramsay, Marco Pierre White. Marco Pierre White, he was the youngest man in Britain, in fact, in the world, to get those Michelin star restaurants that everyone covets. He got, I think, 3 stars only by the age of 33. Got his first one at age 22. And Marco's story is interesting because he started off in poverty, learning how to make simple meals with very few ingredients in very simple ways, but always to the utmost quality. And then he goes through all his fine dining phase and creates all this crazy stuff that you would expect in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant where you don't know if it's more art or food or how you're supposed to even eat it. And he went through that for a number of years. And by the time he was 38, he gave all his Michelin stars back. And he started rejecting all the fine dining. And now here is Marco Pierre White, one of the world-renowned chefs who taught one of the world-renowned chefs, on YouTube, teaching people how to make the recipes that his mother taught him, going all the way back to the beginning. But now, with a few of those techniques and insights that he had during his time at the Michelin star restaurants, I like to think that Job and Ecclesiastes kind of take us on a similar journey. We are given the fundamentals here in Proverbs. This is what you're supposed to do. Fear God. Don't lean on your understanding. Fear God. Turn away from evil. And then Job and Ecclesiastes kind of take us to this different area where it's like, wow, this is just completely having me rethink what it means to fear God. But in the end, Ecclesiastes says, that was the beginning of wisdom. Now here's the end of it. Fear God and keep his commandments. Because God is going to bring every deed into judgment. Every secret thing, whether good or evil. Fear God and keep his commandments. That is the all of man. Despite the troubles of an apparently vain life, where the highest aspiration of man is to eat and drink, our duty is always as it has been, to not trust in our own understanding, but to keep understanding that God is over all and he is someone who is above the sun. The preacher only understands what is under the sun. To trust in an answer that is beyond what we can see and experience. To trust in an answer that Paul gives us in 1 Corinthians 15. In discussing the hope of the resurrection, I'm pretty sure Paul has Ecclesiastes in mind. He says, "The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." We've overcome the one thing that makes life vain for everybody, death itself. And so therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. Jesus is the one who has rescued us from this vain life. He is the answer that the preacher could never find. He is the answer that the final commentator hoped for. He rescues us from the vanities of life and is the perfect reason why we should always fear God and not trust on our own understanding. because there's a lot of stuff we can't see. So if you want more to life than lunch, the only answer, the true end of the matter, is to fear God by being in Christ. And if there's anything we can do to help you achieve that, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing?